Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Now, when I say the phrase New Age music, you're probably not terribly excited. You might be frightened, even possibly disgusted. Even people who enjoy much of the New Age, its imagery, its meditation practices, its sort of mixture of hedonism and metaphysics, might find the idea of consciously choosing to listen to New Age music a bit of a stretch. Wonderfully, however, as our guest today will show us, the category is actually much more interesting and delicious than you might suspect. Our guest today, Douglas McGowan, is a record collector and record label owner who has just put together a wonderful collection called I Am the Center of privately issued, meaning not from a major label, New Age music, I think mostly from America. And it's been a revelation in my household. And some of this material I was familiar with. I'm kind of a record collector. I've stumbled across some of these things here or there. But I didn't have quite the vision to recognize how deep and rich the vein is and how wonderfully it makes us reflect on what music is for, how the sublimity of music can affect us, what it means when people decide to put out records on their own labels and avoid the whole machinery of major labels, especially before the internet when everything was so easy to share. And so it's really been a wonderful ride, not least of which because much of the music is quite sublime. And I realize that a lot of the sort of trippy, psychedelic, and electronica music that I also listen to overlaps quite richly with straight-up New Age records that have, you know, mystical covers and funny-sounding names, and you imagine are purchased by, you know, middle-aged ladies with purple gowns and strange Atlantean headdresses and things, which is all actually pretty wonderful when you think about it. So I look forward to our conversation with Douglas today, and now we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. I'm a middle-aged lady with purple gowns.
It's funny I said that, and then I realized that was kind of maybe a little mean, but it reminded me of this experience I had that I'll never forget. It was so wonderful. I was in England, in Cornwall, and I was with a friend, and we always like to go to weird sacred sites just as sort of, you know, goofy tourists. And we were at this sacred well, and we're sitting around. It's basically a tree with some interesting dangling ribbons from it right beside this ruined chapel that had a little sacred well bubbling at the edge of the chapel. And this, you know, middle-aged lady with wearing purple came through with this guy, with this American guy who had a military cap on. And she said, "Oh, do you have your dousing rods?" And I was like, we were like, "What?" And she goes, "Oh, you must have your dousing rods." So she pulled out these two dousing rods, and she gave them to us.
Wow.
And then we proceeded to go into the chapel, and lo and behold, I would be lying if I denied that these things regularly and consistently swiveled in our hands to point towards the sacred well. So you gotta love it.
You gotta love those middle-aged ladies wearing purple. When you see one, don't be all, "Oh God," because they probably have something at least entertaining to say.
Exactly, exactly. So I know that, like, probably the category of New Age music is not one that you normally would leap to. But how did you find some of the recordings this week?
You know, it's funny. As you know, I like a lot of heavy metal, but all kinds of music. I really, you know, if I was to say what I listen to the most, people might be shocked to find that it's actually gospel and like old blues stuff. But Having said that, I do listen to some New Age music here and there. I have to say I usually can't stand that yoga music. Having participated in Kundalini yoga classes here and there, it's always just been like fingernails on chalkboards. But having said that, I actually found some of the stuff on this compilation really not what I expected. Like you said, I was like, wow, they really have a pretty good diversity, because I usually, some New Age music, it's just so froofy for me. It doesn't get in deep, but I did like, actually, there was several songs on the album where I was like, I could totally listen to this, like on a regular basis.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, that's, I've been listening to it on repeat. Well, let's bring Doug onto the show. Doug, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, guys.
So once again, yeah, real good. Congratulations to you. It's a great success. I hope it does really well. And you're in that interesting place that some sort of collector music scholars get to do, where you actually kind of identify a zone that as being valuable that a lot of people kind of ignore. And even though the category of New Age music has been around for decades as a marketing term, as a term that people identify with, most people who aren't already signed up to the whole worldview have probably gotten pretty used to ignoring it entirely, especially now that most of it is in the past and a lot of it is tough to find because it's on private labels and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a fun place to be, I can imagine, to kind of draw attention towards this sort of unexplored or under-acknowledged vein of music.
It is. I would liken it to like giving permission to people to look at something or enjoy something. And I had somebody do that for me in like 2004. A guy named Anthony Pearson, who's an artist, got really excited about some really cheesy-looking records that somebody had brought over to his house to sell him. And I thought it was a joke at first. And you know, like, I think a lot of people have that same reaction. And, this was one of the most intelligent people I knew, and I thought, what does he know that I don't know? And I went home and I realized I actually owned a couple of these records already. I'd been enjoying them. Peter Davison, Yasos, Jeffrey Chandler. And these were, like, dollar bin staples at the time. And they were just good electronic music to me. And but when he just threw a frame around it simply by liking it, it sort of set off my thinking in a different direction, and it took me on this like this journey where I don't want to say I'm an evangelist. I want to think of myself as a popularizer of this stuff, because I do think it has of utility and value for people.
That's interesting. You use the word utility, and I think that's one of the things that you need to do is that at some point, if you become interested in this music, even if you initially just interested in it musically, like you said, oh, it's good electronic music, and it reminds me of space music from the early 70s or whatever. At some point, to really embrace it, you have to kind of not buy into, but embrace the fact that this music is not just made to enjoy as music, that it's explicitly designed to produce effects, to be used in certain ways, to support and amplify people's spiritual practices and their spiritual lives and their sense of moving towards some kind of higher state of consciousness. And even if that's not your zone, like even if that's not the way you live your life or think about the world, it's pretty hard to go as deep into this music as you have if you don't kind of sort of appreciate that process. So I'm really curious, coming from the perspective of a record collector and a music fan and interested in hidden zones of music, how was it for you to go through that process as you started to kind of realize how deep the sort of New Age musical drive was?
I think a lot of the process just starts with like the accumulating urge, like the collecting urge, and the gimme records kind of thing. And it had like a nitro boost in about 2007, because I became aware that the medium really lives on cassettes. And so it was like picking mushrooms or digging for gold, where you find like a huge vein, and suddenly, like, you've been having a good day, and suddenly it you realize, oh my goodness, like, there's way more here than I thought, and also nobody else seems to know about it. And so as far as the thing is that I'm not really. I don't really consider myself a spiritual person, but I kind of, and I don't think I had like these sort of real like moments where I felt like I was becoming a spiritual person very often. But to me, I can recognize in myself how many different problems I have and torment in my own head and everything. And to me, this music is. It is addressing that. The best music is addressing that, and I think it's that dynamic is sort of like a reflection of the fact that I think a lot of the musicians are in. I don't want to sensationalize it, but I think a lot of them are tormented people too, and so you know what I mean.
No, absolutely. I totally hear you. I mean, the way I hear it, a couple of reactions. One is that when I got the advance, you know, I started listening to it, and it reminded me of things that I owned or that I had listened to many years ago, maybe even periods where I was more of a spiritual seeker or doing certain things than I am now. But what really happened is that I realized that I kept listening to it partly because it was feeding me in a way that a lot of the other music I listen to doesn't quite do. And that was cool, that was good, just that alone. And that if I paid attention to it, I realized that was partly out of a certain generosity. These musicians are mostly not so much interested in challenging someone as sort of taking them somewhere or encouraging them to move somewhere. But it because these the particular tracks that, you know, the cream of the crop are also intelligent and nuanced, that it's not just some kind of band-aid, you know, on the difficulties of things. You can kind of feel how you got to go through difficult stuff to come to a place of, well, you use the term sublimity to describe some of the greatest music here. And whether or not you're a spiritual person, you respond to that kind of sublimity. And I think one of the reasons that people don't, that this was a treasure trove, an undiscovered territory in the incredibly picked over world of, you know, 20th century recordings, post-war recordings especially, that it's because people are just freaked out by the idea that to have any relationship with this stuff, you sometimes somehow get stained with, like, you know, the horrible New Age cliches, when it's actually a much more nuanced world with lots of different kinds of characters in it. So tell me about some of the characters, some of the people you either you met personally or you got to understand through their biographies that gave more depth to the music.
Oh gosh, I don't know where to start. Is any name in particular?
Well, let's see. We're gonna hear a track from Daniel Emmanuel in a second. We'll probably put that on,
right.
But maybe before we listen to it, you could give a little story about him and how you came across his music.
So I was on a road trip all around the west side of the country, and I came down to Dallas, and there were 600, I estimate, sealed copies of his two albums under the racks, marked 99 cents each. And I just immediately recognized these are electronic music albums from the early 80s. You know, and just right there, it's, what are these doing here? And I popped one open and listened to it on my portable, and it was mind-blowing how I thought, you know, this is the new Cary Riley here. And so I bought 50 of them. I brought them back, and they all sold really quickly. And I connected with him over the phone, and I said, I loved your stuff. And he told me about how he had kind of abandoned the records in an attic in Dallas and moved outside Houston, and he was surprised to hear that they were there. And it started this friendship that it's hard to put into words. I mean, he's such a generous person, as you put it, and he really helped me understand in a very intuitive way, like, what motivates people to do this music. It's like a form of service. It's like, what, you know, this is what I can do for the world, is offer this stuff up. And you know, just to come back to what you were saying before, I mean, I think that the key is, like, it's liberating to get away from a fear of something, whatever it is. And the stain of New Age, as you put it so aptly, is such a fun process to go through, finding out that you love something you thought you hate. And we all have examples of this, and so I think that's sort of the process that a lot of people go through with this stuff when they become obsessed with it. And so many of them come from backgrounds of especially I find that there's a rap New Age connection, which is, I haven't totally wrapped my head around it, but
that's pretty peculiar.
Heavy metal as well. You know, I definitely think, and one of the guys on the set, Mark Banning, is basically a heavy metal guitarist who has a New Age side. So, I mean, you know, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this.
No. I think it's good. I mean, we'll listen to the track in just a second, but just to respond to that a little bit. I mean, I can't speak so much from the rap side, but from being a metalhead, it's a very easy kind of continuity in some ways. There are these sort of epic places of that are very driven by affect, by a sort of emotional tenor. You're not really paying attention to the words, you can't understand them. Even if the rhythms are completely different, there's sort of an opening to a kind of expanse or a kind of epic feeling or a kind of intensity. And the other thing about it is that I find one of the reasons I love metal, and I particularly love metal shows, which a lot of people think are ridiculous, and people I know who are too sophisticated, they wouldn't go to that. One of the reasons I go is because they're almost universally generous. Everybody's there to have a good time, and the band is very aware that they are entertainers, even if they're acting as if they were, you know, demons from the abyss. That they're there to also please the crowd. And there's something about that generous gesture in the midst of this very emotional music that I think is quite nourishing, even if it seems like it's like dark and spooky or nasty or angry or whatever. I don't know if you have anything to say to that, Maja.
No, that has been my experience at almost every single metal show. I mean, you'd think that the Hesher dudes would be like jerks, but I have found the opposite to be true. They're usually super considerate. And I've gotten, like, as a woman being at a music show, I can say I've gotten more disrespect at pop shows than I ever have at a metal show.
That's interesting. Well, let's listen to this track. So this is a Daniel Emmanuel, and this is just a short section from Arabian Fantasy. So let's listen to it. I just love that piece. As soon as I heard it, I tracked down your reissue. I think you reissued his record, right?
I didn't.
You didn't. Somebody else did. But anyway, I went out and I just thought that was totally marvelous. And one of the things about that track that points to a lot of this music is there's a willingness to let the melody be
exotic, imaginative. You know, like it's taking you somewhere, or reminds you of some place, a storybook, some strange fantasy kingdom. And they're willing to, like, include that imaginative feeling beyond just the sort of texture of the music. And one thing about your compilation that made me think about that is that you decided to start off with something that's clearly from an era before the New Age, which is an excerpt of the wonderful music that Gurdjieff, the great rascal spiritual teacher in the early 20th century, made with one of his disciples, Thomas de Hartmann, which is an extremely evocative piece that also has that sense of those kind of spectral melodies that call you to some other realm. So, I mean, I'm kind of interested. Do you find that sort of, like, that this music isn't just to give you a support or to make you feel spiritual, but almost to, like, take you somewhere in the imagination, somewhere beyond some strange kingdom? Is that part of what the appeal is?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's it's kind of an escapist fantasy element that is it's something you more kind of associate with, like, teenagers imagining getting away from this place, whatever that is. And one of the things that never gets remarked on is, you know, Yasos, who I think most people would regard as sort of the top dog of this whole thing, he would tell you that he doesn't have any musical influences from this world and that he collaborates with a transdimensional spirit named Vista. But if you really kind of badger him about it, he'll tell you, you know, the first record he ever bought was, I think he was either Les Baxter or Martin Denny. And I think that's really telling. You know, I think that exotica music was a massive influence on his brain as it was, coming into adulthood. And I think that I'm not even sure how consciously aware he is of how that influence manifested itself. But once you know that and you go back and listen to it again, you realize, oh yeah, that's exactly what this is. This is exotica music 2.0, you could say.
No, I think that's a very astute point. I mean, and that's one of the fun things about playing as a collector or curator or writer about these genres, is that they ask us to kind of look back through time. Like, once we understand what New Age music is from, let's say, the mid-70s forward, you can kind of start to look back and go, well, whether or not these influences are direct or indirect or they're just in the air, there's a way in which there are elements of this music that you can go all the way back to classical music in the late 19th century. There are certain passages and places in Rimsky-Korsakov where you can hear the gesture towards this kind of expansive Orientalism or whatever. Or the great example of Gurdjieff. So that's a pretty rich one. Was it weird to decide to put things in the collection that were, like, at the time not New Age music, something like the Gurdjieff tracks? And I think there's one or two other ones that are older numbers. Did you want to make sure to put this in a tradition that goes earlier than the emergence of, you know, synthesizer music in the 70s?
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, to me, it was always an automatic thing. And we kind of joked around about saying New Age in America, or New Age 1924 to 1990, which would have been kind of a joke because the second track is from, I think, 1968. But, I mean, and we marked it at 1950 because that's when de Hartmann recorded the Gurdjieff piece on the set. I mean, my whole, like, insofar as there was, like, a mission was I was trying to, like, connect it to all the other parts of musical culture that I could, and just show that, you know, it's not this sort of island of music that's unattached from popular culture. It's part of popular culture. It's not a very beloved part of popular culture in the larger public's mind, but, you know, that should change because it's connected to it's connected to everything else, and that's a good thing.
Well, and part of it we haven't talked about that I think is really important is that it also very much anticipates the kind of turn towards the DIY, the idea that groups of people distributed randomly who are putting out records on their own labels or on small labels that are starting to cater to a very niche audience can nonetheless develop a whole space that becomes very complex and in some cases makes, you know, a good deal of money for some people. I mean, my memory of this, and this dates me, is the emergence of Windham Hill Records, which is not unrelated to, you know, it sort of shows the more dangerous drifts of New Age ultimately. Yeah. But there are some great records on them early on, some of the guitar records in particular I really love. But it wasn't just the music, but the packaging, the production quality, a certain kind of spaciousness, a certain kind of reverberation that sort of invited you into a relaxing kind of contemplative place. But I remember buying those records even at the time going like, these guys are doing something different. They're like building their own little world in a way that we're much more familiar with now, where there's so many media outlets, there's so many niche markets, et cetera, et cetera. But at the time, there was something kind of radical about these guys putting out their records in the way that they did. Am I right?
No, and it was quite organic, and it wasn't a very it was only clear in retrospect what it was, what you're describing. I don't think anybody at the time realized that they were building a DIY movement, and it basically just came down to the fact that you know, people like Yasos, they shop their, a lot of them shop their records around to the majors, and they couldn't get anywhere at all, which is kind of amazing to think about now. But the only people doing any type of new, what we would call New Age stuff in the 70s in America, now I'm going to leave out all the krautrock and everything else coming out of Germany and France and everything, but it was people who had established themselves in the rock medium, like Carlos Santana or jazz, Alice Coltrane and Charles Lloyd. You know, these are people who had established themselves in these sort of accepted normal quote-unquote forms of music. The majors weren't interested, and they didn't get interested until they saw how much money Stephen Halpern and Wyndham Hill were making, and then they came in and they helped ruin it really quickly. and they opted for the music of the mid 80s and onward that sort of incorporated a jazz influence and basically dropped the spirituality and said, you know, this is, if for us to reach a wider market, we have to drop all the crystals and all the sort of the woo-woo stuff that gets a minority of people excited and it turns off everybody else.
Well, and that's like that. Eric mentioned the amazing covers and the artwork, and Eric, as you know, Jody Wiley's my neighbor. She did the Source Family documentary, and she has this collection of New Age record covers that she's been kind of putting together. And I was going through just the images of the artwork, and like you said, I mean, so one of them has like Jesus with a UFO on it with like rainbows and crystals on it. And like at the time, you know, this is like, you know, like you said, pre-internet, before all this stuff was breaking into people's popular consciousness. So to put Jesus with a UFO on it on your record cover is a pretty bold move. I mean, to their credit, I got to say, like, they were going for it. These people, they were dedicated. They were not concerned about judgment, and they were going to put it out the way they wanted to, you know, even though, like you said, there was a kind of lashback later, but at the time it was pretty punk rock to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was totally unironic. It was you could say it was naive, and I don't think something like it could exactly ever happen again now, because everybody's too savvy about how they're going to be perceived by others. That kind of putting it out there is something I think is very much maybe lost to us in the internet age now, and it's kind of too bad, I think.
No, that is a great sadness that we're kind of, in a weird way, condemned
to sort of retrospectively find these traces of that kind of naivete. I mean, it's still around, it's still in pockets, it's still there, but yeah. I do think that the internet encourages a certain kind of knowingness that really changes our relationship to music. But that's okay. I mean, the 20th century is still the archive of the 20th century means that there are still so much maybe materials that are still mapped, but they're undiscovered by me. You know, they're undiscovered by individuals who are just, you know, finding this music through your label, through your records and your label and other means, even after the fact, after the collectors have gotten there. And there's still a way that kind of to inspire that sense of the creativeness of what you could also call naivete.
Yeah, I mean, Simon Reynolds wrote this book, Retromania, you know, and he talks about all the pros and cons of it, but the basic conclusion is that we're going to be going back to the 20th century forever. We're going to be it's like a well of inspiration and sort of whatever you want to call it, that we're always going to be rehashing it now because of the you know, because of the internet and the ability. The way I always put it is that, like, progress was moving in a linear direction, one direction into the future, and then with the sort of the rise of the internet, I think that progress in many ways now moves outward in a more timeless way. We get a fuller appreciation from the things that happened up to now rather than coming up with new ideas. And that's, you know, it's a good and a bad thing.
No, I think it's very, very accurate. We actually had Simon on the show to talk about Retromania, and I really buy a lot of the model there and what you're talking about as well in its pluses and its minuses. But we got to take a break right now, so we'll come right back. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Douglas McGowan about I Am the Center, a wonderful compilation of New Age music, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Douglas McGowan today, talking about New Age music. A lot of people might get annoyed just to hearing that word, but it's worth giving a little try. So I wanted to ask you, Douglas, about something that we were talking about earlier in the conversation, how the music attracted you and how we were, and just even listening to that track, you can see how New Age music can get into some of that atmosphere, more kind of dark spaces. And I was curious if there were any artists that you have listened to, like maybe some of them on the compilation that you did, that were able to like break something loose in you or put you into a trance, or you were able to have a kind of spiritual experience. Was there any that really just got in there and like kind of revved you up a little bit that you can think of more so than the others?
Yeah, no, there were. Daniel Kobayalka did, I don't know if it was a track on the compilation Blue Spirals or if it was from his first New Age album called Timeless Motion, but I had a time, and I think this has only happened to me one other time, which was when I was watching The Passion of Joan of Arc, where I realized I was mesmerized to the point where I was hypnotized listening to it, and it was like a refreshing thing. I mean, it was sort of like I don't know, it's sort of like my mind had a little shower or something. I felt really amazing after that. And another one I would say would be this summer when I was traveling down to the Bay Area to meet up with Yassos and a couple other people, and I just sort of had this sort of, this wasn't from listening to the music, but more from talking to Yassos, where I sort of had this light bulb moment where I got what was meant by timelessness, and that maybe that the secret of life was as simple as your entire existence is whatever is defined by whatever you, wherever you are right now. So you don't have the, it's not an option to be unhappy or to be stressed out, because if you're happy, your whole life is happy, and your whole, from beginning to end, and that's hard to explain, and on my best days I have a hard time putting it into words, but it made perfect sense to me that the reason that a lot of these musicians appear so youthful, I mean, a lot of these guys are approaching 70, but they look like they're in their 40s or 50s. I honestly believe is that they don't spend all of their time in the linear time plane, in their sort of going out of this world through their music or through their meditation or whatever else it is that they do. They're not aging as fast as the rest of us. And I find that idea really compelling. And I think there's some truth to it.
We were talking about like the mechanisms of this new age music, right? They're trying to do something. And if you think about that in music in general, I mean, you know, there was like scientists that wanted to take some of Ozzy Osbourne's DNA to see why he wasn't more damaged than he was. So I think like obviously rock and roll and music can be very detrimental to lots of musicians. They'll just like look like they're 1,000 years old. But then there is this quality. I think like when you're saying when people can tap into that place where they get all yogi through it and remove themselves, you know, from real time, they have these freaky abilities. Like you said, like they find that kind of immortality zone or like, you know, place of agelessness. I mean, even though Keith Richards doesn't look like $1 million, it's a miracle that he's alive. And that can be, I don't know, that's like some total sorcery, you know?
Well, I also like the way that the sense of timelessness is so present in this music, when of course music is, you know, by definition occurring in time. And, you know, it's one thing to have a painting about timelessness, but to have music about timelessness is this paradoxical place that nonetheless invites us into different modes of time, different ways we can occupy temporality. And I think part of what's interesting about this music, especially when it is still organic, when it's not been sort of brought into the circulation of, you know, sort of corporate labels and the sort of muzakization of New Age music into the soundtracks for massage studios and yoga studios and all that, although yoga music is an interesting topic has its own dynamic. But is that they're making this invitation, but they're still doing it as sort of as creative individuals, not as sort of like, here's the tape that is going to change your brain and give you timelessness. It's like, yeah, well, this might give you timelessness, but it's more of this of an artistic gesture, of something that's hard won from a single person. I mean, you really get the sense, even though this music is very impersonal in some ways, there's no singing, it doesn't have like, you know, obvious, you know, it doesn't based on song forms that we can recognize, da-da-da-da. It still is. It's very much about these musicians in a way. Like, and you get that sense in the way that you talk about the music. So I want to play a little bit more from the. How do you say his name? Is Daniel Kobialka?
Kobialka.
Kobialka. So we're going to play that in a second, a section from Blue Spirals. But can you just say a little bit more about him? Like, where what's his motivation? Where he comes from?
You know, I've never spoke, well, no, I spoke to him for like 5 minutes, and he's a very private person, interesting guy, but he was the lead violinist in the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, and he, kind of came up as sort of a more avant-garde, violinist, he had some records on Advanced Recordings, which is, you know, the sort of the names are escaping me, but it was much more sort of an academic and sort of experimental type of music. And I don't know really exactly what it was that motivated him into the New Age world. I mean, I think Andy Kohlberg, who he collaborated with on these recordings and is responsible for, as far as I know, everything other than the violin work, was a huge part of it.
One thing that was interesting about the description that you gave in the notes for the record is again that he refers to what we think of as sort of highbrow composers, symphony composers,
right.
Lou Harrison, Toru Takemitsu. But I, as a lover of both Lou Harrison and Toru Takemitsu, I can also say that I partly listen to their music for the same reasons that I listen to your album, the album you put out. I mean, there's something that's in that highbrow stuff that is also very generous, very spacious, very spiritual, very giving in that way. So he seems like a very interesting figure because it shows again how the boundaries between what you'd think of as a popular or even sort of low genre like New Age music actually has really complicated relationships with a wide variety of music in the 20th century.
Definitely.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Blue Spirals. I love that that downward arpeggio, and it brought up a question for you, which is that even when this music was put out, Stephen Halpern certainly did this, and many of the artists, I don't know about the ones on your compilation exactly, but many New Age recordings have this sense that they're like brain music, they're brain machine music. Like that by listening to this music, you can help alter your consciousness. It will produce this effect. It will produce this sensation. It will change your brain waves even. There's this kind of like science/sort of pseudoscience language about the effects of the music. But of course, music does have all sorts of really interesting effects, and there are brain machine music that clearly puts you into an altered state pretty reliably. So I'm curious, did you dip into any of that kind of side of this music in terms of your research, trying to figure out what kind of claims people were making, where there seemed to be some truth in it, that whole sort of kind of programmed aspect of the music, which is so distinctive about it?
Yeah, I know, and it's I don't want to sound cynical. It's the area where a lot of the humor comes from for me, because I'm looking at a tape right now called Dual Delta, and it says Brain Hemisphere Harmonic Healing, and it comes in a clamshell case to sort of because it wants you to know that this is serious stuff. So they didn't put it in a regular tape case; they put it in a clamshell